Well, tonight you're going to listen to a fantastic story about lost Mayan technology. But for the first couple moments, we're going to be talking with our guest, James O'Conn, about his work. He's a professional engineer, and we're going to get his take on Hurricane Sandy and get his thoughts on just why the beach houses were destroyed when they should have been able to resist some of the wind. We'll get into all of that in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. James O'Conn has combined his very unique professional engineering experience with the exploration of ancient Maya ruins and the quest for lost Maya technology. Now, with the collected field data from Maya sites, he's been able to apply digital engineering tools along with engineering skills to verify feats of Maya engineering. His breakthrough discovery was the Maya suspension bridge constructed over a river which divides Mexico and Guatemala. It is now considered to be the longest bridge in the ancient world. It's an amazing story. We're going to also tap into James's mind right now as a professional engineer to get his views on Superstorm Sandy and why it caused so much damage. James, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing fine, and thank you for having me.
I'm looking forward to this. Let me take just a few moments here before we get into your work, The Lost Secrets of Maya Technology. This Superstorm Sandy, as an engineer, were you mystified by the damage it created?
No, it was a typical large hurricane strike, except it, after all these years, since the runaway train of 1938 struck a very highly populated area of New Jersey and New York that weren't built in the right places.
So when you say they weren't built in the right places, too close to the shoreline, what?
They were built on land that was at or below sea level, or just 2 or 3 feet higher.
Okay.
I actually went on Google Earth after the storm and looked at some of these areas in Staten Island and along New Jersey. I was shocked to see how low these buildings had been built. I mean, 2 and 3 feet above sea level, going back hundreds of yards. And then I looked closer, and there were no dunes or breakwaters or seawalls or anything that you find in other areas of the country and the world that protects the area, the localized area from tidal surges and storm tides.
The subways, the tunnels, they flooded. Anything that could have been done to prevent that?
Absolutely. You know, I used to walk along. I worked in New York City for 8 years during my salad days. And I often thought about it, but then I acted like a New Yorker with the arrogance. That'll never happen here. It will never have a storm that would cause a flood tide. That would cause the Battery or any other part of Manhattan to flood, particularly around the perimeter where the rivers are. And those rivers are actually tidal estuaries, and every day they have like a 6-foot tidal flow. I've done tidal projects in tidal areas from Boston to the Keys. I have a lot of familiarity with the areas, and I always look down in the subways. I said, if they ever fill up with water from a flood tide, how are they going to get that water out? Have they ever figured out a methodology for pumping out or keeping water from going down? Because you walk along the street, and there's these grates, and you hear the subway right below you, so you know the tunnel is down there.
It's and right there, yeah.
They're just huge maws waiting to catch all the water that comes in, and of course that's what happened. And how do you prevent this? I've done several projects that were not subways, but they were in areas that had floods, and they were the owners were trying to protect computer areas or electrical areas or sensitive areas, and they had floodgates that they put up and sealed off areas that would permit water to flow into them. And now I see news stories coming out in New York that they had planned. They had plans for years and years. I remember this even back in the 70s when I was working there, for building seawalls because the big one hadn't hit since 38. Okay. And they didn't build it. There was a series of three walls they're going to build, seawalls they're going to build. And then there was another series of smaller ones. And now they're thinking about going to a small scale plan. This is thinking now because this has only happened a week ago.
Right.
Where they would put floodgates at the entrances to subways and tunnels. That's another thing. There's 10 tunnels that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Brooklyn and Queens. And they filled up and they've got to pump all those things out. And they never had a provision in any of those, or they never retrofitted any of those in a case that there would be a flood. But one of my big projects was the now functioning, 40 years old almost, the tramway over the East River that goes from Manhattan to Roosevelt Island. And it was the first rapid transit or mass transit facility was back up after the storm because it was up in the air on cables. So, but I did some alternate studies on that route that looked into other methods. And during that time, I ran into the subway issues where I kept thinking, what it happens if the big flood comes and they fill all these subways and tunnels up with water? How will they get it out? Well, that's what they're facing now. I have heard reports, I'm watching on television, the news, that they're talking about months to get these subways in lower Manhattan pumped out.
Oh, at least, you're right.
Yes, and they never set up a methodology to seal these guys off and put in submersible pumps. And I mean, this is such old technology that they should have had it already set up, and they didn't. So, now they're talking about not being able to afford it, and everything's too expensive. And then they're talking about the brilliance of New York engineers and designers. Well, they got to have money. Whatever happens, they got to have money to build these retrofits.
And I would anticipate, James, I think it was the lack of money or funding that caused the whole problem anyway, isn't it?
That's it. That was at the beginning, and then there's arrogance. New York thinks that it couldn't happen there. I did a retrofit to a very large housing project of condominiums on the New Jersey side of the Hudson, right across from Columbia University. And I couldn't convince those people they were in danger that somebody built some condominiums over an old Ford plant, which extended 1,500 feet out into the river with a pier. And it was just totally deteriorated, and I just couldn't make them believe that they were susceptible to hurricanes, to flood tides, to all the things that you see from Key West up to Boston. In fact, I'm working on a project right now in the Keys at Isla Mirada that is right behind the monument. There's a big monument there dedicated to the 3,800 or more men that died on a train. It was a famous train that was washed away by a tidal wave or a flood surge in 1938. They were trying to escape from Key West to get to Miami, but the storm caught them halfway between two places, and they just washed the cars up out to sea, you know, and everybody was killed on them. So I go, when I experienced just standing in front, I got goosebumps right now. I experienced standing in front of a monument like that, reading what happened. I'm going, God, those poor guys, they should have known.
You imagine being on those trains, those cars, when that happened?
And trapped.
And trapped. Nothing you can do.
Right. So we got and let's go to the coastal communities. FEMA has reported that they have offered reductions in flood insurance and other attractive offers to these people for not to build close to the water, not to build without protection, not to build where the water is, the land is too low. There's a whole list of things. And developers have ignored their attractive offers and gone ahead with the developments that are, you know, too low. I mean, 2 or 3 feet above sea level. And these are all just Well, I have a conundrum here. I see the places which were wiped out or just damaged by they were higher than sea level, where the waters came in, and then the waters receded, and the damage was there, and you see all the debris piled up. Then there's other areas that are still underwater. Well, those places have to be below sea level. I don't know how they let them build there, or how they survived that long.
There should have been a zoning code or something there, Jim. Huh?
There's no laws. I remember designing buildings in New York City with the building code, and it was so outdated. I mean, they've changed it now, but buildings that were built in the 70s and before had such low wind pressures on them for hurricanes. They didn't have a hurricane load. Like, if you're in Miami, and I did a project, Fort Lauderdale, okay? Two projects there recently. And they've got winds of 80 and 90 pounds a square foot on each side of the building. One push and one suction. So you get 180 pounds a square foot. New York had like 20 on buildings that were 50 stories high back in before they changed the code.
Right.
So those buildings were built with, without enough protection. Then they've changed the code now, but the thing is, it's too late for those. And the new buildings have got the new requirements, but it still leaves them totally susceptible to the flood tides and the water and the wind. The wind, you don't even hear about people complaining about the wind because it wasn't even a Cat 1 when it hit New Jersey.
No, it could have been worse, right?
Yes, it could have been worse. The wind could have got into it because most of the damage in any big storm, and they're calling this a superstorm because it's New York, and
it was just heavily populated.
Well, it's a couple of things. They did have a big tidal surge, but they had a full moon, which always makes the tide
that's
higher.
That's right. That always
at
adds
time,
to
and they it hit an area of houses which were built right down in the ground, without any protection, and they just got washed away, and.
Yeah.
They were not built properly. Now, I was one of the first responders to Andrew in 1991, and I was in shock driving down the thruway to Homestead. I had some projects at the Homestead Air Force Base that I had to go check on, and I had the only hangar left intact. I was really pleased with that, okay? Because I put the roof on a little differently. I dug the foundations a little deeper. I didn't dig them. I designed them. And the door's a little stronger,
designed it with that in mind, didn't you?
Yes, I knew that something would happen, and I argued for the fact that they would leave the doors open in case of a sudden storm. And sure enough, these guys left the doors open. Well, you leave a hangar open, you got all that wind coming in and blowing up, then you've got the aerodynamic effect of the storm pulling up on the roof, so you got a double trouble there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as I was driving to the base, I saw nothing but bare plywood or just open roofs all the way. All the houses had been denuded of their roofs. Lots of blue plastic or the bisqueen on the roof. And after that, I read that the roofs had not been nailed down properly. The plywood had not been staggered in a manner that would cause them to resist wind. Things that now are absolutely in the code with tie downs, and these are not expensive things. It's just building the right way, and they made them move back from the shoreline. But of course, Andrew was almost 200 miles an hour. The issue there was not the water; it was the wind.
Well, if Andrew or had Sandy been like Andrew and hit New York and New Jersey, the devastation would have been absolutely unbelievable. Biblical
horrible
damage. Yep.
It would have been like they said in Ghostbusters. Events of biblical
proportion
are going to hit New York.
Yeah, that is.
And
so true.
And what we see there now is what we touched on it is lessons learned. You would think a city that's that sophisticated with all the resources in the world would have known better, and it's been since they said 1821 since the last big storm. I think there's been some other ones that hit in between, but particularly on the coastal areas where there are residences. One of the big problems they have is finding housing for people now, and everybody's all upset with the government, FEMA, the president, because they can't buy gasoline. Well, that's something that's in the private sector. You know that I'm in Atlanta, and we had a nice storm here 30 years ago that knocked out the power for 6 weeks. And we didn't have to worry about that much cold because it was in March, so it became spring by that time. It was already in April and May by the time we got power on. But you know, it was tough, but we didn't blame God or we didn't blame anybody. We just knew we had to get it out of the problem ourselves. But they have a mentality there. First of all, they have arrogance. Listen, I was a New Yorker. I know how they act, okay? And they think they can do anything, just will it away, you know? Last year when Irene hit, I remember interviews on the radio with people that said, I'm not going to evacuate. I'm not going to worry about it. They're just trying to scare us.
Just stay with their houses.
I didn't hear any of that this time. And
no.
You'll never hear it again in these people's lifetime.
Would you build a seawall now?
Yes. But
would.
The question is, can you afford it? It's going to have to be absolutely. Well, okay, we got two different situations. The New Yorkers are talking about their seawall to protect the city. And then we got New Jersey and Staten Island.
Right.
And all those different communities down the coast that need dunes. I remember when they were building dunes back here in the South 30 years ago because they did not want to have to build seawalls. They built up the dunes and planted seagrass on them. It was much more beautiful. But you had to destroy a lot of houses because the dunes take some room up, but it did protect people from the flood tides. So they've got to do something, either a structured wall or build the dunes back. So, or both. I have a condo in Mexico that in Cancun that gets slapped around every time there's a storm. They got a seawall and dunes.
And it still gets hit.
Yes, sir.
Well, you know, James, when Mother Nature decides to do what it does, there's really not too much you can do about it, is
there? No, you can't. Mother Nature is a bitch. And let me tell you, I'm not being funny. I love her, but she can do the most strangest things, which may lead us into the Maya, because Mother Nature slapped around the Maya and destroyed the civilization. But that's another story, okay? But that's exactly what happens here. And when you get north of, well, let's say North Carolina, you very seldom have these large storms. And it wasn't a superstorm. They never had that real perfect storm effect they were expecting from the low, which is coming down from the north. I don't think that ever contributed. It's coming in now, but it's not adding to the agony of Sandy.
Okay, well, you stay with us, James. We're going to come back in a moment and talk about your work, the Lost Secrets of Maya Technology, in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. And in a moment, we'll get into, with James O'Conn, the Lost Secrets of Maya Technology. You know, this is something that has fascinated us for years. He has done extensive work here. We'll get right into it on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, James O'Conn with us. James, your book, The Lost Secrets of Maya Technology, how did you even get involved in this subject?
In the subject of archaeology or the Maya?
Both of them.
Okay, well, I had a 10th grade teacher. I was always an avid reader. I still am. And he taught about, instead of Napoleon and Charlemagne, he taught about cult religions, disappearing civilizations, and that kind of thing. And rather than the normal history, and I became fascinated by them and started reading about those things. And it led me into reading about the conquest of Mexico and Peru. And at that time, there wasn't much written about the Maya because they were a mystery then, like they are now. I mean, they're big in the news now. And I took a year sabbatical down, bought a Volkswagen camper, 1967. Took my wife and children, and we traveled down south of the border and all the way to what was called British Honduras. It's now Belize. I like that name better.
It sounds better, doesn't it? More romantic, isn't it?
Right. Anyway, and spent time in the ruins, camping. Not, I never camped. I was very careful in the jungle because there's things out there that will eat you. There's less now, but there was a lot more then.
Well, it just takes one, James.
I want to make sure that you didn't visualize me camping in the middle of a ruin with all kinds of creatures around. Anyway, I got to know the ancient cities and felt a kinship with the engineers, the ancient Maya engineers that built these amazing high-rise cities of cast in place concrete. Of course, I'd ask a Maya archaeologist who was a Mayanist. I said, how did they make their cement? He said, that's not cement. I had my hand on this gray wall, hard as cement.
Rock, yeah.
And they rocked rock. And I'd say, but this is a structural engineer talking, a registered engineer at the time even. I said, this feels like cement. It looks like cement. And it holds this, story, high building like cement. It's got to be cement. And they said, impossible. The Maya could not do anything that was that kind of high-tech because they were a Stone Age people. Well, there was two insults. One, I saw concrete. Secondly, I couldn't believe that Stone Age people could build this kind of structure, and the kind of projects I saw, plus the incredible artwork that was all over the place.
Without equipment, by the way, right?
Absolutely. You had to have hard tools to work those fine lines and all the incredible the three-dimensional bas-relief sculptures. And as the years passed, I went back, and this is when I started working in New York and started visiting the Yucatan. And then I came back to Atlanta, brought the firm back with me. Long story, but since the Yucatan is only 2 hours away by airplane, I spent a lot of time traveling back and forth over the years and started putting together papers and delivering these papers about how the Maya developed technology along with their sciences, because you're probably aware that they were absolute marvelous astronomers, mathematicians of the first order, and developed one of the five original written languages in the world. That's what the Egyptian and the Chinese and Phoenician and the Indus River. I mean, it's unbelievable right there in the isolation of the Yucatan. So I started delivering papers to international symposia, scientific, archaeological, and I got a lot of attention. People started believing me. And then I discovered, the ruins for the bridge I was talking about, you talked about, in Yaxchilan, that's the name of the city. And I put the whole thing together and did some three-dimensional fly-throughs and convinced the engineers and that it was a real project and it really worked because the city needed a bridge. That was the whole thing. The city needed a bridge, and that showed them how it was done.
Well, you know, James, I've seen bridges built over the Mississippi, over the Missouri rivers with incredible technology. It takes a long time. They're building them with steel and, and concrete and everything else. But these are magnificent structures built with our technology of today. How in the heck could a Maya civilization even construct a bridge without apparently having the kind of technology you need?
The mentality they had in the whole civilization was we can do it type of thing. Okay, they can solve problems. They were had a really great cognitive thought process was developed by this quadripartite cosmic philosophy that got into their sciences, into their agronomy, and into the technology. It was generally civil engineering, you know, water and structures and stuff like that. So they needed a bridge. This city is on an omega in this big river, and during the rainy season, the river swells 45 feet deeper, and it's 600 feet wide, and it moves very rapidly with large debris like 8-foot diameter trees floating down.
That's a good-sized river.
Yeah, but you can't cross it. That was the thing. And so they had this great protected area, but people could not get off for 6 months to go over to the agricultural lands.
So I mean, could they take little boats across?
Well, they could if they survived, but they put the by the time you got 600 feet, you might be 3 miles down the river.
The current was that fast.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's very fast. And if you wanted to forget about cargo, trading, or carrying anything across, it was food like that. So they built two piers right at the edge, real deep. There's a shallow shoulder on the river, and it goes very deep, like 300 feet deep, they tell me. I've never been down there, but I know it's shallow on the edge. And they were made out of cast-in-place concrete and stone facing, which bonded everything together. And they got to the top. And they built these arches called the Maya Arch. It's their basic building block, but it's all out of concrete and stone. And then they strung rope cables between them. Now, the rope they used was the rope the whole world used later, made out of cannikin or sisal. It was worth 18,000 PSI. I mean, worth in terms of engineering. I mean, they only needed like 6 1-inch strands to span the whole length. Now, the middle part was 206 feet, which is like 63 meters. And you had 25 or 30 meters on the outside. So you had basically what wound up as like a 300-foot long span. And from these ropes, they would put suspender ropes down and put a platform. It would be like Indiana Jones's bridge in the Temple of Doom. It was a basic bridge, but it had a really high-tech structure that was holding it up, and they had to replace the cable, the rope, each year because it was a vegetable product, and it had so much rain that it would have the tendency to rot out. So they how do I know that well? The Incas are still building them down there in Peru, and they replace them every year. So I figured Maya had to do it too. It's only logical. So that's how they built that bridge, and it lasted for a long time. The entrance to the bridge is they call it Structure 5, and they never knew what it was until I stumbled on it by surveying and discovering that I had the two piers in the middle of the river which aligned. And then they perfectly aligned with this structure, which was like a platform of stairs going up, hieroglyphic stairs with carvings on it. And the stairs didn't say this bridge was built by Shield Jaguar, the king. What it had was like a history. Anyway, I used aerial photography. I used satellite photography. I mean, everything you can imagine, and computers and 3D fly-throughs, virtual animation. And once you showed a picture, particularly it was like a cartoon, I got people believing me. So it was first published in Civil Engineering, which is an engineering magazine. And then George Stewart, who was editor of archaeological editor of National Geographic, picked it up there, and the rest is history. I got in the history books.
Well, you did. I mean, how old are the civilization? How old are we talking about here, James?
The longest civilization in history, 3,000 years, till the 10th century, 910 was the last date we see on any of the monuments in all these cities. They had 50 city states. So I include myself in the archaeology gang, and if they started around 2000 BC, and they terminated just about 1100 to 1200 years ago.
Do you think when they started 2000 BC, they had that kind of knowledge and technology to do the things they did? Or did that come later, 1,000 years later, or whatever?
Okay, 1,000 years later would have been 1,000 BC.
Right.
By that time, they were start 1,000 BC. They started 2,000 BC. If they started 1,000 years later, that would have been 1,000 BC, which is a good date you picked, because that's about when they really started building cities that had structures. And then around 300 BC, they invented the process for making cement, which we, the Western brilliant people we are, didn't patent until 1851. So when they discovered the Maya civilization in the mid-19th century, there was no cement. The cities were all built with it, but the British didn't invent it for another 50 years or 40 years.
I mean, so how could that happen, James? How could we have a civilization that would create cement thousands of years ago, and we couldn't do it for a couple thousand years later? It's amazing.
It's amazing because they had a process. If you look through the book, you see their cement kiln, which is basically a thermodynamic reactor, or like a blast furnace. It was made out of wood, which was the fuel, and they had a hole in the center, a cylindrical hole. They stacked lumps of limestone on top very neatly, because that's what the picture shows. So these are actually photos of people using this process in the early 19th century, because they were rebuilding Chichen Itza, and they needed cement, and they made their own. So they start the fire in the middle, and it would get hot, and the temperature would, pressure would go down, and it would draw in cool, fresh, oxygen-rich air from the outside, and make the fire hotter, and that would draw in more cool, fresh, oxygen-rich air. So the cycle would repeat until the wood burned at around 1,400 to 1,600 degrees Celsius. Wood usually burns around 400, so they had it up four times more, and it was enough to melt the limestone and turn it into cement. Now, this took like 36 to 40.
So they didn't mix it with water or anything like that, or did they have to?
They made the cement.
Okay.
And they ground it up and made the powder. Then they mix it with water and aggregate and cast in place concrete. But you got to start with the cement.
That's right. And is that the process we use now when we make cement? Same thing.
In the book, there's a chemical analysis between Maya cement and Portland cement, which is our modern type of cement. It is so close, it's like 97% similar. The same chemicals, composition, the same percentage, not the same, but close, really close.
How would you rate their engineering abilities at that time, James?
Well, really good, but they had time. They had a lot of time to do whatever they wanted to do.
Yeah.
So it took them, can you imagine if we had 3,000 years under our belt? Hey, we walked on the moon almost 50 years ago.
I know it.
I mean, it's like, so what if we did something 3,000 years ago? Where would we be in time and space and in technology and science? So they were smart. They had this motivation to carry out science, technology, and agriculture, which is a very important thing, and developed these great cities with 270-foot high. They had buildings that we didn't exceed in height, multi-story buildings, until 1885. I mean, it's astounding. They built all these buildings, and people went in, and they discovered them, and they said, where did they build? Well, the thing is, they stood up for 1,000 years under the attack of the jungle, hurricanes, earthquakes, etc. So if they weren't made out of cast-in-place concrete, no rebar, just cast-in-place concrete, and stone as a composite, they would not be there. They were made out of masonry and, say, wooden roofs. We'd see nothing but a pile of, particularly the jungle tearing apart, but a pile of rocks. And you could never tell how to put it back together again. I mean, these buildings stood, when they chopped the, cut the vegetation off, they were pretty intact.
Was this trial and error? Do you think they built structures that crumbled because they just didn't make them right?
No, I think they did have some, yes. They use a heuristic, which is like trial and error. Our computers are using that now. That's how your computer learns how to do things with you, okay? And we learn that by trial and error as we grow up, okay?
That's right.
So they had a lot of time. I'm not saying that they were the most brilliant people in time, but they were really smart. And they had writing, and they had methodologies for writing down the method for doing things like building a building and stuff like that. So I think that you relied on that because priests who came with the conquistadors, some of the priests were able to read the Maya writing, the script, were amazed at the amount of information that was in their books, you know, natural history, medicine, science, et cetera. But we don't know anymore because we didn't save anything. Only four books were ever saved from that whole
light years library. Ahead of people. What do you think happened to the civilization in general? I mean, there are some people of the Maya culture scattered around, but not a lot. I mean, in essence, the civilization we know of is the Mayans. They're gone. What happened to them?
Well, let me start first. There are about 5 million Maya who speak Maya right now in Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, that's our British Honduras, and Honduras and El Salvador. The civilization failed around 900. It failed because engineering and technology failed them. They grew to be a civilization of 15 million people, an artificial number because the land would only support 2 to 3 million people, but engineering with the water systems and the road systems and the agricultural system that they were able to grow four times the amount of crops on these with the kind of vegetables and produce they had.
Because of their engineering?
Yes, they used raised fields, they had every irrigation systems. And remember, we were in it. Oh, I haven't just said this yet.
Hold on for a second, Jim. We're at the top of the hour. We'll come right back with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.